The adolescent is an outsider
to everyone except his 500 closest friends.
To harried parents, he is a disaster area. To high school convocation lecturers, he is the future hope of mankind. Point of fact, he is all these and none of these. He is an in-betweener. A young person who has left the sheltered, obedient, warm world of the child and whose citizenship papers have not yet been certified by adult society. His experience is of the child. His expectations are adult, and his actions are therefore predictably erratic. Parents almost never know their adolescent. When he's with them, busy with adult things, among adults, he acts grown up and he feels himself very much so. But when he is with his own, he goes along. His moods change like the whirlwind, from the desire to press that accelerator pedal down tight against the floorboard to a passionate commitment of a day-long car washing for the United Appeal. He goes along, he improvises. Where are you going? Out. And literally, he does not know further than that where he is going. He does not make plans. They go with the mood of the moment. And sometimes, for reasons which he could not explain to himself, he balks. He holds back. The adolescent lives in a world apart, a world set aside. He is confusing to society, which does not know quite how to regulate him, to his parents, who have learned to pace the floor and bite their nails, waiting to hear the car drive up into the garage, and most of all to himself, because he has not yet learned who he is. He has not yet been able to separate out what he expects of himself from what parents and teachers expect of him and what his own age group, his friends, expect in him. Now, by and large, the adult world takes one of two attitudes towards this world of the adolescent. There is the smile and forgive approach. Boys will be boys. You've got to expect a few gray hairs when your children are growing up, so grin and bear it. You were young once. And there's the head-shaking approach. I don't know what this younger generation is coming to. All right, I was young once too, but this is absurd. Those who take the smile and forgive, boys will be boys approach delight to quote a statement by Socrates about the troubling youth of Athens 2,500 years ago. Plato quotes Socrates to this effect. Children now love luxury. They have no manners. They show contempt for authority. They are disrespectful to their elders. And they love to be idle instead of to exercise. They contradict their parents. They are rude to company. They eat like monkeys. They sit without modesty. And they tyrannize their teachers. Now, we could write paragraphs from our own experience to this text from ancient Greece. It has a remarkably contemporary ring to it. And indeed, the passage from youth to maturity has never been smooth sailing. We can give body to this from our own Bible. Think of the young David,
who threw up a secure future on his father's farm to run away for the glory of wearing the uniform. And one can almost see Jesse shaking his head at the foolishness of youth, of which for a moment of military glory, a headline fame will throw away their security, their future, all that the father has planned for his son. And we read in our Bible of the young Joseph, pampered, overprotected, bitter-tongued, sarcastic, who not only brought tears to his parents, but roiled the entire structure of his home and family life. And there was Moses, adopted to the plantation, who throws away his special privilege to be one of the original freedom riders. And I can imagine to myself what his princess stepmother must have said to her courtier friends in explanation of why this gilded youth should have demeaned her by throwing his lot in with a slave, canai, and rabble. Our young people give no more and no less of anguish and heartache to their parents than did the great heroes of the Bible to theirs. And in this there is some measure of comfort. And indeed, this boys will be boys approach does have the virtue of making us a little bit more relaxed when our darling, clean-faced, shaven, always obedient, suddenly breaks curfew, suddenly erupts in vile language, suddenly talks back to us. We wonder, first off, whether we have spawned a freak, some monster, whether our child is suffering from some terrible emotional instability, whether we are going to be social outcasts and parias because he has been rude and surly to our friends. And if you're ever at a teenage social occasion, you'll see in the corner of the room the suffering few, the parental chaperones, commiserating with themselves, exchanging confidences and confessions, and finding in the sympathy and the company of misery a softening of the blow. It's good to know that we haven't been singled out by some malign fate, and that this young person has a pretty good chance of growing up into sensible adulthood. But for all of its virtue in making us a little bit looser, easier in our minds as far as our being parents, this approach, grin and bear it, smile and forgive approach, I'm afraid has often been one which has caused us confusion and led us to make some serious mistakes in relation to our children. Because it tends to offer us a ready excuse. If we can label some erratic mischief of our child, some vandalism, some aggressive behavior on his part as adolescent, and since adolescence is predictable and seemingly inevitable, it should follow that this behavior is permissible, is excusable. And we avoid that awful moment of truth when a father must screw up his courage and look his son square in the eye, or perhaps up into his eye, and bring down the rod of parental authority square across his back. There are moments to be firm. All parents want joyousness, happiness for their children. And some of us, I am afraid, out of a pathetic desire to make our children's lives the happier, have avoided authority, have dismissed the responsibility for discipline, have avoided speaking up and speaking back and enforcing. We forget that in the adult world, we require law and law enforcement to settle society. The adolescent world requires authority and discipline, not one whit less, and indeed quite more. I remember often the line from the book of Proverbs in our Bible. He who withholds correction actually hates his child. And he who loves his child disciplines him early. We do our child no favor when we withhold from him correction. A child wants to know what is expected of him. And how can he know if we do not make this visible, clear, and forthright to him? A child needs to be reined in. We learn a lot from Mr. Freud. He taught us to understand the awakening of the natural, raw, roiling energy which is life. He taught us that adolescence is a time when emotion is uncovered beneath emotion, when passion suddenly bursts out. He taught us about instinct. And acting on this teaching, we tore down one by one the traditional restraints and the traditional disciplines. We were afraid to damn, to repress, to hold down. We were afraid that if we did so, we would somehow contort and distort personality. But we forgot in our reading of Mr. Freud, deliberately or perhaps accidentally, we forgot that he taught us also about sublimation, about that unique, very natural human emotional endowment, which allows us to dam and to channel the raw energy which is life into constructive and positive and beneficial interest. A child can be rid of his excessive energy as easily in acceptable sport as in unacceptable aggression. A child needs to experiment to adventure in life. We can as easily satisfy that urge to adventure behind a laboratory desk as in the backseat of a car. Indeed, our children need to be shown how to dam up the raw energy which they feel inside of them. They want help in the channeling of this power. And only as we make clear to them, thus far shalt thou go and no farther. This is what is unacceptable. This is what is not permissible. This is what is against the law, against decency, against morality. And here are the channels, the interests, the goals, the passions which are desirable and beneficial and helpful. Only insofar as we make this crystal clear can we help the child to grow to adulthood, to be civilized. What a waste it is when all that boundless vitality which is youth has no other release than just a purely physical one. If I had my way, I would like to erase the word adolescent from our language. Etymologically, it means nothing more than growing up and becoming adult. But by common usage, it has been associated with a number of stereotypes. The dangling cigarette, the vacant stare, the black leather jacket, the ill-cut clothes, the daredevil driver, the hot rodder, the gang. Now there are young people, you see their pictures on the mass media and the newspapers, who are the quick flesh to this stereotype. But how many? 500,000? A single act of violence, a single knifing, makes the headlines in our papers. And if there be throughout our country 500,000 of these overly aggressive, violent youth who are not only uncomfortable with restraint, but who refuse to accept the yoke of discipline and authority, there are 32 million teenagers. 32 million teenagers. 31 and a half who are decent, who are struggling to become adults in a dignified way, who want to find for themselves an honorable place in the adult world. These are the most forgotten generation of all. They are seldom studied. They never make the headlines. We see them, but we do not see them. And the person who says, what is this younger generation going to? He lives with them, he lives among them, but he does not take them into account. For to him, the adolescent is the headline. The the bloodletting, the gang rumble, the terrible crash of high-speed cars. The 500,000 of the troubled and the troubling, of the disturbed and the distraught, are a serious social and civic problem. They require massive psychiatric aid and rehabilitation. The solution to this problem would require an attack with all of our civic energy upon the cleaning up of the backwash of the slums of our city. It would require a new attitude towards parenting by some of our most affluent who think that they can buy the affection and the loyalty and the decency of their children. Society has not yet shown that it is willing to meet head-on the challenge of these 500,000 disturbed children. But it is not of these that I would primarily speak this morning. I would speak of the 31.5 million, of the decent, the troubled but the decent, the disturbed but the good, of the young people who will grow up to become, if we permit them, fine citizens of a fine nation. And I would speak of two challenges, two problems which uniquely confront them because they live here and now. As members of a highly industrialized society, as citizens, young citizens of America in the 1960s. The first problem of which I would speak is the problem of job opportunities. The second problem is the problem of moral standards. We read in our Bible, "When thou shalt eat of the labor of thy hands, happy shalt thou be." It is an ancient truth that life has joyousness to it, only insofar as there is an honorable life interest, an occupation, which is respectable in the eyes of society and of interest to the person who is engaged in it. Those who have retired without making plans know how days can become nightmares, and empty days a hated burden. Now, what is ahead for our young people? For those who are academically able, the problem of growing up, as far as jobs is concerned, is simply a problem of choice. There are many opportunities. Though we have 6 million unemployed in the United States, there are 6 million and more jobs vacant, going begging. Teaching, nursing, social work, recreation, medicine, the ministry, all the occupations, all the professions which require special intellectual skills suffer from a dearth of qualified people. The young person who can get good grades, who can compete in a verbal and intellectual society, this person has only the problem of choice, of making up his mind. Now, he is the happier, the earlier he can make up his mind. The best adjusted teenager remains the one who early on selects the interest which will be his and busies himself with test tube or library book or project preparing for that future. But I'm disturbed by some statistics. 41.8% of our 18 and 19-year-olds were in college last year. And if we assume that another 20% of our young people are qualified for college but disqualified by lack of financing or by their environment which failed to stimulate them for such a career, we still find some 35 to 40% of our young people cannot cut the cake in an intellectual atmosphere. What of those who have mechanical and manual skills, but who lack the academic skills? What is their future? 100 years ago, the Industrial Revolution did away with the craft guilds and the craftsmen. And now we are living through the age of automation, which is doing away with manual labor, with a blue-collared worker. And soon the office help, the bookkeeper, and the secretary will be placed by electronic computers and various electronic secretarial aids. What is to happen to the young people who are qualified largely for jobs in this range, who are willing to give their bodies, their hands, their skills, such as they are, to gain employment? Our schools do not know what to teach them. We created two generations ago the vocational school to prepare people for the various craft unions. And by and large, the union roles are closed. Their apprenticeship programs are closed because the unions cannot provide a full day's employment for those already on their roles. Guidance counselors do not know what to tell these young people. What kind of future is it to be growing up into if the society has already told you, we have no place for you? Your future is a weekly trip down to the Unemployment Compensation Bureau. Now, these children, many of them are dimly aware of their future. They live in homes where the father, 10, 15, 20 weeks each year, pounds the pavement, knocks on doors, which never open. He, too, wants to support his family. He, too, wants to earn the bread and the shelter and the clothing which they require. The society has already said to him, you lack the skills we require. We throw you on the human refuse heap. I lay a great deal of the unrest and the restlessness of the younger generation to a dim recognition on their part that there is no future for them. But society is not prepared to accept them. They have built, in a sense, a counter world to the adult world because they know that they must live in that world the rest of their lives. Now, what's for it? I'm afraid that the only solution which is available to us is one that runs counter to every prejudice and preconception of our free market philosophy. The only realistic solution which is available to us would be the creation of a massive, expensive, and permanent public works authority, a craft and conservation corps, which would guarantee to these young people employment in forestry, in conservation, in recreation, in handcraft, in all of those areas which cannot show a profit per se, but which would add to the beauty of our life, the cleanness of our cities, the health of our citizens. It will be decried by the taxpayer as boondoggling. It will be decried by the unions as an invasion of their authority and of their livelihoods. It is a program which is part and parcel of the philosophy of a welfare state. But what other solution is available to us? How many hundreds of thousands of young people can we support in semi-permanent idleness? How many rehabilitation and psychiatric institutions can we create to house them when they come with their various disabilities, which they will have built up because they are not wanted? Can we continue to absorb into our society tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of bitter young people who will be angry, aggressive, violent, who will disturb the peace because they are disturbed within themselves, who will run to every demagogue and every hater of mankind, who will constantly be a burden, socially, psychologically, in terms of law enforcement, in terms of morals and standards and public safety? I'm afraid that only if we are prepared to admit that such a welfare program is the price of technological change, will we be able to combat effectively the hurt, the psychological damage, the alienation of tens of thousands of the young who cannot compete because of their native endowment in the world in which most of us live and fulfill ourselves, earn our livings. The second of the problems with which I would deal touches each and every one of our teenagers. Those who have studied the adolescent world tell us that one of its characteristics is the inability of the youngster to relate to adult life. He does not want to be deeply committed. The term that the sociologists use is alienation. The term that the youngsters use is cool. The highest praise that one young person can give to another is that he is a cool customer, which translates to mean that he has the sense not to be taken in by the blandishments of parents and teachers and of authority, by the disciplines and the hopes of the adult world. He holds himself aloof, above. He will not be taken in because he will not be let down. What is life without passion? What kind of life is it if we are not heated up for ideals, to fulfill ourselves in our profession and our business, to find strength and love and decency for our families? It is no life to live in an emotional and spiritual deep freeze. Now why? Why are young people so interested in being alienated, cool, part of a counterpart world, set aside, walled out from the world which is ours? I would submit to you that they are cool to the adult world because the adult world is cool to the values which it prates. We talk of honesty, but around the dinner table, we tell our wife about the quick buck we have made. We talk of peace, and we spend $50 billion for a military budget. We talk of civic involvement, but our government must mount national campaigns every 4 years to get out the vote. We talk to them about continence and abstinence and physical things, but then we gossip gaily about the marriages into which our friends have fallen in and fallen out. The image which the young people see of the adult world is one of hypocrisy. Promiscuity is glorified in the mass media. The church may thunder against it, but all that they see and know about their parents and their parents' friends and the adult world tends to make them know that promiscuity and infidelity are acceptable things. Teachers' pulpit speaks to them of honesty, of integrity. But they know that when the giant corporations of America are accused of conspiracy against the law, the boards of directors of these corporations excuse such actions, rationalize them, and find no guilt in their own souls. If we are concerned that our young people are getting out of hand, I submit to you it is largely because we as adults have not ourselves in hand. We have been permissive with ourselves as well as with our youngsters. We have given in to the desire to have a ball, have a fling, enjoy ourselves, give in to our instincts. We have rationalized and excused every petty desire. We have broken down the disciplines of manner, dress, of morals, and we wonder why the young people are not deeply committed to the morals which we prate to them and preach at them. They see the hollowness of our preaching far more accurately than we see it ourselves. Now it is difficult for those who are morally committed, for you and your families, to maintain the decencies in a world gone half mad in the pathetic search for pleasure. It is hard, I know, to maintain the integrity of your family life when the television and the newspapers and the cinema and the film constantly din into your ears that licentiousness is permissible, and indeed it is the glorious, dramatic, free way of living. Unfortunately, we have no consensus in America as to moral standards. Certainly, we have no consensus as to standards which are abided. In smaller societies, in more primitive times, when religion and culture intermixed, the child had a very clear model set before him of what was expected of him in the adult world. There were evil people in every society, selfish, greedy, but by and large, the society did not tolerate their violence, and it was very clear what was expected of the good boy, the well-brought-up young lady. This is no longer clear, this image, to our young people today. They do not know what is expected of the stalwart youngster and the fine young lady. The image is blurred. The edges are uncertain. We speak in a straight-laced manner from the pulpit. We speak with a permissive tolerance in our homes. We speak with a desire to glorify the violent and the licentious through our mass media. And they wonder which of these images is the real one, the one for which they should co-opt, the one by which they should abide. If we expect our young people to grow up without some of the aggressive restiveness, rebelliousness which we see in them, we will have to grow up ourselves and become morally and spiritually of one piece. Once we set for them the hero image, the societal image, once they know, because they have seen, they will grow because they know. I began by quoting to you the words of Socrates. Children now love luxury. They have no manners. They show contempt for authority. They are disrespectful of their elders. They love to chatter instead of to exercise. They contradict their parents. They are rude to company. They eat like monkeys. They sit without modesty. And they tyrannize their teachers. We took some comfort from the fact that the context applicable to our day was actually a text of 2,500 years ago. We relaxed with a certain degree of relief. But I would remind you that the generation about whom Socrates was speaking was not strong enough nor committed enough to maintain the democracy of Athens. It was this generation of troubling youth which brought about the tyranny, the fall to Sparta, and the destruction of all that we call the glory of Greece. Are we prepared to pay such a price? Or are we prepared to take ourselves and our marriages and our families and our businesses in hand, and through them, to make clear to our teenager what we expect in him because we expect it of ourselves. Amen.